This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. In a lot of ways, the most fascinating and important city on earth is Jerusalem. The staff of the Trumpet is launching a new website called Watch Jerusalem. And on the program today, we're going to talk with our bureau chief in that city who started a new weekly podcast this past Sunday on this subject. He's going to talk about why it's so important that we watch Jerusalem. America's gang problem is probably worse than you realize. The number of gangs and gang members has been increasing dramatically in recent years, and their contribution to crime, especially in America's big cities, keeps going up. What is contributing to this trend, and how bad is it going to get? Some prominent voices in America are openly, unapologetically advocating lawlessness in the form of not enforcing immigration law. President-elect Donald Trump says he plans to deport criminals who have immigrated to America illegally. And there are leaders in several American cities, universities, and even churches who say that they're not going to participate. It's a really extraordinary trend. And I'll conclude the program today by talking about some things I'm thankful for. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Trumpet Radio has a new program on our schedule, Watch Jerusalem. This is something the Trumpet's editor-in-chief is very excited about. He's personally requested that we create this program. We're just going to listen to the introduction of this new program now.
Crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
So that is the introduction. We've also launched a new website by the same title, watchjerusalem.co.il, or you can get there by just going watchjerusalem.com. And to talk about this new initiative, the new podcast, and what else is happening in Jerusalem, we have the host of that program. This is a voice very familiar to those who listen to this program, trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall. We have him via Skype from Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello, thanks for having me on your show here today.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. You serve a lot more of a purpose on this show than I would on your show. Congratulations.
We'll see.
On your first program this past Sunday, you got that under your belt. You covered a lot of ground in that program. It was great.
The program itself, depending on how what happens during the week, we'll air it once a week. Every Sunday it'll air on KPCG, and then it'll be available for download just like the other programs are on KPCG or live or streaming at different times. But it's really going to be a news-driven program, the radio show. Depending on what happens during the week, it'll be heavier on the news from Jerusalem, analysis of events taking place in Israel, if there is something big. And if there isn't, it'll probably swing more towards the archaeology side of things, and looking both at things that have been discovered recently, but then also taking a look back at, over the discoveries of the past 50 years, 60 years, things that haven't really got that much of attention, or maybe they did when they were found, and yet they're lost from public consciousness right now. So we're going to try and bring those up, dig those up, and then put it back out there for people to understand just how many biblically significant things have been dug up on these excavations.
Yeah, you brought a lot of those facts out in that first program, just how many discoveries there have been over how many years and how many biblical personalities have been confirmed, and really fascinating. I would encourage anybody who hasn't heard it yet to go and to listen to that first program. So Well, tell us about the purpose of it. Why, you know, why Jerusalem? Why not Munich or, you know, any other city around the world? What is it that we're trying to accomplish? Who's the intended audience, and what are your goals?
Yeah, so Israel and Jerusalem, Jerusalem specifically, is a very important city. We've got a featured article up there on watchjerusalem.com right now, you know, why you must watch Jerusalem. It's written by the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet magazine and the leader of KPCG as well, Gerald Flurry. And he wrote that, where we put that up there so that people can see why we are watching Jerusalem and not watching, like you say, Paris or another city. And for in-depth reasons, I would look to that article. But basically, we know that Jerusalem is the center of world events. Things that happen in Jerusalem tend to ripple across the rest of the world. It is a place that people can look to as well for specific biblical prophecies and their fulfillment, and knowing where we are in Bible prophecy by watching the events that take place in Jerusalem. And so it's very important for anyone around the world to be watching Jerusalem. But this website has more of an Israeli audience in mind, as opposed to thetrumpet.com, which is definitely for everyone across the planet. Watch Jerusalem is as well. And yet we're deliberately going to be targeting and looking for an Israeli audience more than anything else, just because they themselves are very unaware, it seems, both of the prophetic significance, a lot of events that take place in Jerusalem and in the Middle East, but then also they're unaware of the archaeological discoveries that are happening underneath their noses. And like, I'm in contact with people on the street. I've got some friends, play basketball with people. I meet up with people that aren't in the archaeological world, everyday Israelis, and they wouldn't have a clue what's going on, what's being found. Or even religious people might not know what's being found and what can really be something that would strengthen their faith. So the direction of this website is definitely tending towards that audience most of all. We're going to try and not use terms and different passages of even the New Testament to try and make sure that that a Jewish audience, Israeli audience reading an article wouldn't be put off just by what seems a Christian message. But we just want to show the facts. We just want to show the facts from their Bible and the facts that of the biblical discoveries that are being confirmed from their Bible in their own country as well. There is an audience out there, I think, that would be captivated by this, but there is no real news organization that focuses on it. Yes, you'll have a discovery, and then the news people, they would put out a story, but then 2 days later, it's gone. And yet, this is something that's really important that should stay in people's memory for far longer, and that's what we're going to attempt to do.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that article by Gerald Flurry about Watch Jerusalem, and he's actually been talking quite a lot about all of the biblical passages that talk about just how invested God is in that city. You also mentioned just how that city really kind of sets the timetable for biblical prophecy in a lot of ways. What's happening in that city ends up giving you a benchmark for many other prophecies to give you a sense of just where we are. So there are a lot of reasons to watch it. How much has Gerald Flurry been involved in just talking with you, giving you direction that we want to feature this and this and this, and just your personal conversations with him?
Yeah, well, from the very beginning, it's been years now that Gerald Flurry has asked for and has been thinking about a website that's specifically tailored to the Jewish nation over here. And it's just one of those things where we've been trying to get the resources to do it, and there's been different priorities that have taken place or taken the priority of where we need to direct our limited resources to. And yet once I came over here, it seemed like we had somebody that could be more dedicated to ensuring that we had a website now that we've got somebody here. So for the past 6 or 7 months, he's been heavily involved and consulted about exactly what's on the site, what shouldn't be on the site as well. He's very happy that we have this two-pronged focus, both on archaeology, history, and then also prophecy as well, because they really do go together. There are end time prophecies which concern the discovery of things in Israel as well. So he's been involved very much in that. He knows exactly what's going up. The layout of the site and how it should look. And he's super careful to not offend anybody, to put anything up on there that somebody would look on the site and say, well, I'm not going to read that article because of this, that, and another reason. He really wants people just to see the message that God has for the Jews and for Israel, and to remove any obstacles that they might have before they would even read it. That we have to understand, for a Jewish audience, they see things from the New Testament or New Testament chronology, or even the word New Testament, and to them it is like the Quran for a Christian. It is that much of an anathema. They do not, they wouldn't even read it. So we're just trying to, we're telling truths from the Bible, but we've decided to use, as per Gerald Flory's direction, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, looking at Jewish artifacts, to really just show them what's right underneath their noses as much as possible. And even today, I mean, it's just before I got on here, I just looked in the analytics page, and we had somebody from Haifa here in Israel looking at the site. So that was a good sign. It's a small beginning, and we hope to do some advertising here in Israel in the future to try and promote the site so that they know it's there. But really, that's the main audience we're going after, and that has followed the direction straight from Gerald Flory.
And to that end, the language barrier is another obstacle that we're trying to surmount. Maybe you can just tell us about another member of our team over there that is aiming at overcoming that.
Right. One thing that Gerald Flory did say is that he really wanted it out in Hebrew as well, a Hebrew version of the site, because while a lot of Israelis do speak English, it's not their preference. And there are definitely some that don't speak English, especially some of the more Zionist ones that believe in Israel's right to this land. A lot of them, you know, that do live in the settlements in the West Bank and such, they don't really have haven't mastered English that well. So we do have another member of our team here, Christopher Eames. He's also a part-time archaeologist, and he's worked over here for a number of years on the excavations, archaeological excavations. He's going to be helping out writing for the site. And then also he's right now immersed into a Hebrew course to try and develop his skills to get to the point that we can ensure that once we get things translated into Hebrew, that he can read over them, ensure that the quality is good and that the meaning is conveyed accurately. So we're investing a lot of time, resources, money into making the Hebrew site. The Hebrew site, I would say right now, would only be, it'd be less than 6 months away, hopefully 3 or 4 months away before we have that. So it's going to be here really soon.
And we'll be using professional translators to make the articles in the English language in Hebrew.
Right. We'll be making professional translators will be doing it. It would be a very tough ask to get somebody to learn it within the space of 5 or 6 months and then to translate high-level English into Hebrew. So we're getting Hebrew speakers, natural Hebrew speakers, Hebrew translators to do that. And then they'll do it initially. And then Christopher Eames, again, will look over what they produce.
Maybe you could just tell us the kinds of source material that you're pursuing, both in terms of the news and the archaeology end of things. Where do you go? Who do you talk with to stay up to date on those things?
Well, there are a number of places that you can go in Jerusalem that do have that do help out journalists to try and give them resources. One of them is Media Central here in Jerusalem. I've been there a few times, and they have press conferences with different speakers that comes and gives you firsthand accounts, and some that might not get published by more of the left-wing English papers over here. As far as archaeology goes, I've always got my finger on the pulse there, just through the Israeli Antiquities Authority. They're good at publishing what they write up, and also just some contacts with Dr. Elot Mazar, Just yesterday, I met with Dr. Joseph Avaram, the head of the Israeli Exploration Society. He's 100, so he knows everything about anybody that's worked in archaeology over here as well. I think that's going to be a really good resource going forward. And we do plan to have original interviews with archaeologists on the program, both Watch Jerusalem, the radio program, the podcast, and then also on this in featured in articles as well. I'd aim to do that probably once a month, both Israeli archaeologists and archaeologists from around the world. It seems like
that's fantastic.
As I've been studying through just what's been found over the years, it seems like from each of the eras, the biblically significant or biblical eras, you do have I wouldn't say as strong as a Dr. Elot Mazar type, but you do have a few that are excavating at key biblical sites that have the right idea. They have their Bible to check out the geography, to know where this site should be. They're looking at it to help them determine whether this place fits the bill from what they're finding. And they are coming up with some amazing discoveries, a couple of them being Jericho of late, and then also a biblical Sodom. And I'm going to try and get the archaeologists from those digs on the show as well in a month or so. So we do have a number of sources over here. It's different being here in Israel, even though I might have access to similar sources that a journalist would in America because of the internet. And you can pick up a phone and talk to anybody. You just get a different sense being on the ground and seeing what's important to Israelis and what's not.
Absolutely. Very exciting stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall, who is heading the new initiative of watchjerusalem.co.il, a new website that is focused on news from Israel and about archaeology within Israel. He's also launched a new podcast by the same title, Watch Jerusalem. I would encourage you to go to the new website, or you can even check it out on thetrumpet.com. We also post the podcast on there. His first program, he recorded this past Sunday. It's on at 10 o'clock Central Standard Time Sunday mornings and repeats throughout the week. You are doing that live, aren't you, Brent?
Unfortunately, I'm not doing it live. We're not set up to do that in my little apartment here right now, but I finished recording it about 2 hours before. So it's pretty
fresh,
freshly minted.
Fresh right off the presses. The name of the first program, The Hunt for More Dead Sea Scrolls. He talks about those scrolls and a whole lot more in that first program. Very exciting. Great to talk with you about it. And we can hear your enthusiasm for the project here through the Skype connection. Thanks for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You're probably aware that America's cities have gangs in them, but you are probably unaware of the full extent of the problem. The United States is actually home to some 33,000 gangs. In America's cities, they're responsible for a tremendous amount of the crime, especially violent crime. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques has written an article about this subject for the January edition of the Trumpet magazine. It's called The Land of the Free, Home of the 33,000 Violent Street Gangs. We have him here in the studio to talk about it. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, great to be with you.
So obviously, gangs have been a problem in the United States for a long time, but it's getting a lot worse in recent years. Tell us some of the reasons why we're seeing a spike in this activity.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it is. It really is getting a lot worse. In 1975, that was the year when they first conducted a nationwide estimate of the number of people in gangs. And at that time, it was 55,000 people estimated to be in violent gangs. And now it's 25 times higher than that. You've got 1.4 million criminally active gang members across the country. And one of the main reasons
Say criminally active gang members. So this is like, how are they finding these statistics?
Well, this is just according to FBI estimates. They compile crime data, crime statistics, and especially in big cities, cities of more than 100,000 people, about 80% of violent crimes, and many of those are traced directly back to people known to be, you know, affiliated or members of these violent gangs. It's really staggering, especially if you consider that 1.4 million sounds huge, but it's only half of 1% of America's total population. But they commit 16% of America's total murders every year. And in those big cities, they commit about 25%, a full quarter of the murders. So they really punch above their weight, I guess you could say, in terms of just how much, what a staggering amount of violent crimes they're committing.
1.4 million people, even though it's a fraction of the population of the United States, that's still a huge number, especially, I guess, if you compare it with the resources that the U.S. has to combat that problem.
Yeah. If you look at the number of sworn law enforcement officers in America, that's a little under 1 million, around 900,000, I think. So that means that for every two sworn law enforcement officers in America, there are three gang members. So the math right there just shows you what a growing problem this is. And it does seem like just in the last 5 or 6 years, the growth of these gangs has greatly accelerated. They say that today it's about 40% higher, the number of people in violent gangs, than it was in 2009. So that's a really rapid growth right there.
Do you have any idea of what causes there are? Why is it growing so rapidly in recent years?
I would attribute it to two main factors. The first one just being the breakdown of families. I think that when you have young people in cities that are living in a family with, you know, one or even both parents absent, they don't have the support that they would like to have. They don't have the, you know, a sense of community and belonging that they would like to have. And so that very often will make them begin to look to their peers to find that sense of community and that sense of support. And so I think that as we've seen more and more families break down, as we've seen the health of American families deteriorate, that's been perfectly correlated to this rise in gang activity. And then another big part of the trend, I think, is just we've seen police in the last few years really start to become fearful about doing their jobs, especially if it's a policeman, you know, up against someone of a minority group of some kind. The media and the whole country is very quick to side with the person in that minority group. It makes policemen and other law enforcement officers reluctant to really do their jobs because they're afraid that they'll be assailed by, you know, the media and others. And so what that does is it makes the police reluctant to really enforce the law. And so the police become timid, and that timidity ends up emboldening criminals. And then the emboldened criminals ends up making the police more timid. It's really a self-perpetuating cycle.
So is there actually correlative data that links, say, police timidity or reduction in the number of arrests or any kind of law enforcement activity with the increase in, say, a young man deciding, well, I'm going to go ahead and join this gang, or an increase in gang activity in a city?
From what I could tell, that trend of America really turning against police, especially the progressives in America, the trend is relatively new at this point. That's only been in the last 3, 4, or 5 years that people really have this hostile, antagonistic view toward police. So I wasn't able to find anything concretely correlating that. But I do think if you just think about it logically, that it's something that you could see how it would have an effect on this.
Well, let's talk about just the glamorization of gang life that we see so much in mainstream media, in pop culture, and just how much that is increasing the problem.
Sure. Yeah, I think that is a huge aspect of it. Society really glamorizes thug life, gangster life. the United States' second most popular genre of music is hip hop. And even if you just listen to a few of the names of hip hop subgenres, I think it's really telling. Some of those are narco rap, mafioso rap, horrorcore, and of course, gangster rap. That's, you know, in many inner cities, it would be unusual for a young person to listen to any music other than these kinds of subgenres within the hip hop, you know, overarching genre. And in these songs, they hear basically just endless boasts about drug use and drug dealing. They hear all kinds of clever rhymes about misogyny and promiscuity and even rape in a lot of cases. They hear torrents of lyrics promoting violence toward police officers, toward rival gangs, toward anybody who doesn't pay you the respect that you feel you deserve. And so it really, all of this music, which is insanely popular, it really makes thug life seem sexy. It glamorizes it. And this is not just a few obscure artists who are peddling this message. There was a study done back in 2005. This was led by Dr. Brian Primack from the University of Pittsburgh's Department of Medicine. And he looked at the 62 hip hop songs that made it onto Billboard's most popular hits for that year, for 2005. And 77% of them discussed substance abuse, often in the context of wealth. There's another study here, a 2001 analysis from the Journal of Criminal Justice and Popular Culture. And this one found that 22% of all hip hop songs contained misogynistic themes, including depictions of assaulting women, raping women, even murdering women. And this isn't like the songs are speaking out against these kinds of things. It's more like, this is how we live our lives. This is, you know, this is a, what
it's more,
guys
more
do.
Of a, like a braggadocio about those types of things.
Exactly. And if you expand that to include all forms of violence, the figure jumped to 60%. So 60% of these very popular songs discuss just about the most chilling, perverse messages you could imagine. And in some of those subgenres that I mentioned earlier, it's as high as 71%. So that means a minority of the songs don't, or a minority of them would have lyrical themes that don't touch on this, you know, just egregious kind of violence.
It's amazing to consider that in light of, say, the left's attack on Donald Trump as he was running for president, and they just wanted to paint him as a misogynist and a racist and so on. And they're very intolerant of, say, a statement that he made 11 years ago on videotape or that type of thing. There's a high level of sensitivity among quite a number of people to those types of things, except when it comes to this massively popular segment of pop culture. Who says a word against it? In fact, Hillary Clinton invited Jay-Z and some other hip-hop artists to Get Out the Vote concert just the weekend before the election.
It is a really bizarre double standard, I think. Like, Mr. Trump's remarks were, you know, certainly pretty bizarre.
And no one's going to defend
nobody
them.
Would support those. But yeah, just a few days later, you invite a man to publicly endorse you who has gotten rich off peddling a message far more dark and perverse and, you know, promoting of misogyny and violence than anything in that recording. So yeah, it is really strange. I recently read a book called The Hip Hop Wars by Trisha Rose. She's a Brown University professor of Africana Studies, and she really thinks that music and just the whole society's glamorization of hip hop culture.
Yeah, you can see it on television and movies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, she really says that is a huge factor in just tearing apart a lot of inner city youth. There's one quote here after she talks about a lot of the lyrical content in these types of songs. She says, "It's silly to claim that what we consume, witness, and participate in has no impact on us as individuals. The depths of the commercial success associated with violent gang and street culture as authentic hip hop has given violent black masculinity a seal of approval, thus encouraging these behaviors among the kids who are most at risk and who need to embrace this model of manhood if they are to survive. We can't constantly make violence sexy for young people and expect them not to valorize violent action. But the gang problem is bigger than any one race. You know, it's not just something that affects just African Americans or anything like that. There are lots and lots of Latino gangs. There are neo-Nazi gangs. There are violent motorcycle gangs, even Russian and Ukrainian gangs. So it's really tribalism that can set in with any race and any group of people.
How is it that you feel like this, say, the relevance of this subject in light of what's happening politically in the United States, and what was it that got you interested into the subject to study in it?
Well, part of it was just seeing how rapidly it's growing. You know, right now, thanks to America's pretty bloated and incredibly expensive criminal justice system and our bloated prison system and all that, violence for the most part has been declining. But if you look at gang violence, that's been rapidly rising. So that caught my eye just because we are expecting America to really continue to collapse our social fabric. We can see it coming unraveled. And so I think that gangs could become a major part of that. And they already are in a lot of ways. It's we see America becoming more divided racially, and gangs in most situations do fracture along racial lines. You know, it would be sometimes you'll find a gang that includes a lot of different races, but not always. And I think once you have that kind of tribalism and that kind of division, that it can really fan the flames of social unrest.
Well, you're alluding to it somewhat here, but maybe you can just put this in the context of biblical prophecy for us and why this would be critical to keep our eye on in terms of America's social breakdown.
Sure, yes. If you our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has written a book called Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, and it's a very powerful book. It points to several specific Bible prophecies that really prove that in the very near future, the United States will suffer societal breakdown on an unprecedented and utterly devastating scale. And in that book, he points to, well, Isaiah 1, verses 4 through 5, for example, says, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers. Then if you go on a little further, the whole head is sick, the whole heart is faint. And really the head there is talking about the corrupt and intellectually diseased leadership in America. And then the whole heart is faint means the general population is in the same condition. And I think that in society's kind of endorsement of gang culture, you can see both aspects of that. You can see the sick head and the faint heart. Just, you know, neither the leaders nor their followers have the will or the strength to get at the roots of this terrible problem that's getting worse and worse. So, and then if you go on in that same passage, Mr. Fleury talks about verse 7, where it says, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire.
Yeah, that's a passage that he highlighted in a Trumpet article not too many months ago, referring specifically to the kind of racial tension that you see taking place on a greater and greater scale in America's cities. When you add the gang component to it and these groups that tend to be pretty heavily armed and unafraid to commit egregious acts of violence, you can really see an explosive situation in the making.
That's right. On the streets of America today, the lawlessness of gang culture is expanding. It's darkening. It's ruining more and more lives. And as this lawlessness becomes even more prevalent, it will contribute to that wide-scale breakdown that's mentioned in the book and in you know, in Isaiah 1 there. And as Mr. Fleury said, this points to some really dark times on the horizon.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He's written an article titled Land of the Free, Home of the 33,000 Violent Street Gangs. It's printed in the January edition of The Trumpet. That edition just went up online. You can find it at thetrumpet.com and read this article. And you can watch for it. If you have a subscription to The Trumpet, then that will be coming to you very soon. Jeremiah, we appreciate you bringing that story to our attention. There's a lot of really sobering information in this article, and really worth reading. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
When Donald Trump campaigned for the presidency of the United States, he called himself the law and order candidate. He pledged to solve some of the problems like those we were talking about in that last segment, but also especially trying to limit illegal immigration. There are some people in America who say they're not going to go along with him. Advocacy of lawlessness is coming from some quarters, and some of those may surprise you. I have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here to talk about this. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here.
So maybe the biggest issue of Mr. Trump's campaign was immigration, and we have now cities across America who are openly defying his plans to solve this problem. Tell us about this.
Right. It does look like civil disobedience is going to be a really big highlight of, at least for the first beginning of the new Trump administration. You know that there are about 13 million illegal immigrants within the United States. During his first interview with 60 Minutes after becoming president, Donald Trump said that he thinks he may have to deport 2 to 3 million of those, putting preference on those who have criminal records first. But there's quite the pushback against that. The mayors of New York, Chicago, and Seattle have all declared their cities sanctuary cities and said they will not cooperate with the Trump administration to deport anyone from their borders. And it's not just cities. There's actually universities. Harvard, Yale, and Brown University have also at least signed petitions or start circulating petitions to say that they're not going to be participating with any deportation programs. And more than just cities and universities, it's also churches. There are up to 400 churches in America who've declared themselves sanctuary churches, saying that they'll offer refuge to any illegal immigrant who wants to seek it from a government deportation program there.
Okay, so 13 million illegal immigrants, and that's a figure that is under some dispute. I don't know if there's any way to know exactly.
Right. Some push it down to as low as 11 a million.
And I've seen numbers that are even higher than that. But to think that these folks, a deportation is, if you were to just execute the laws on the books, they would all be sent out.
Right. And unless Congress passes an amnesty bill, that would be the law, is they'd have to all be sent out. So if already the U.S. Immigration Department, the executive branch of government, the Trump administration, they're executing quite a lot of mercy
right,
by saying that they're probably only going to deport 2 to 3 million of these people.
Right. So no one is suggesting that we're going to try to deport 11 million or 13 million people. And they're really trying to concentrate their attention on the ones who are really creating problems in America. And you would think that in some of these cities where they're experiencing violent crime at the hands of some of these immigrants, that they would be interested in working with the administration to try to find common sense solutions to eliminating people who shouldn't be there and are creating problems for having been here.
Right. Right. That is unique, is that Chicago, being one of those sanctuary cities, has actually a couple years back declared Shorty Guzman their public enemy number one. It's the first time they've declared anyone public enemy number one since Al Capone was roaming the streets in the 1930s, just because he's saying that the Sinaloa drug cartel is very active in Chicago. And that is primarily the type of people that Mr. Trump is talking about deporting. He's saying that he thinks that there are 2 to 3 million illegal immigrants in America who have committed crimes that he'd like to focus on. And I mean, I've seen other sources that say maybe it's only 1 million that have a criminal record. But regardless of how many it is, those are the ones that he's really looking at deporting.
Mm-hmm. So to focus on, say, those who are the more problematic cases, for these cities to come out and say, these cities and universities and churches, essentially to say, we disagree with even the very premise of kicking some people out of the country who are here illegally and who are committing crimes on our soil. What message is that sending to those immigrants? What message does it say to those who would even want to come into the country, the fact that there's this dispute going on between the highest level of government and, say, localized government?
Right. It does definitely encourage more immigrants from Mexico to come here, and it is even discouraging some immigrants who've come here legally, even though most of the Hispanic community has voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election. They said it was noteworthy that Donald Trump got more support from Hispanics than Mitt Romney or John McCain ever did, largely because there are a lot of the people who did go through the legal paperwork to do this the right way who are kind of upset when they see immigrants coming here illegally and some of them committing crimes. And really turning some of these cities like Chicago into the exact type of environment that they were trying to get away from.
Right. So they'll hear plans to stem the tide, to build a wall, to deport criminals, and they see a lot to celebrate in those kinds of policies.
Right.
So the whole situation with the sanctuary cities, this is one element where we have people who are openly defying the keeping of law, and they're resisting a candidate who says that he's going to selectively enforce the laws on the books in order to eliminate the worst of the criminals who are come about as a result of this. This isn't the only case of dressed up version of lawlessness where lawlessness is made to look like justice. You also have resistance coming from some Catholic leaders. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, just 2 days after Donald Trump was elected, Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez had really given a very emotional speech on how we shouldn't be deporting immigrants. Americans are better than this. We're not this type of people that breaks up families and sends immigrants who are here illegally back to the country they came from. And apparently it resounded because 5 days later he was elected the vice president of the United States Catholic Bishops Conference, which is a rotating position, which means 3 years from now he will become the president of the United States Catholics Bishop Conference. And that Bishops Conference also recently sent a letter to President-elect Donald Trump, which was a polite letter, but basically saying that the Catholic Church has been giving sanctuary and food and care and their charities to these immigrants who've been coming over the border illegally, and they plan to continue to do that. And they're really hoping that the Trump administration will support them in offering that charity work, which sounds like definitely a very polite letter, but when you look at the way it's worded, it's basically said that we've been providing logistic support to illegal immigrants. We will continue to do so whether you support us or not.
What is the motive, in your view, for these Catholic leaders to make this move?
Right. Well, Pope Francis especially has been very supportive of the Barack Obama's amnesty bill and the move to get more immigrants into the United States. He's lobbied for us to, first of all, make it easier to make immigrants come here legally. And second of all, it does seem to some of his words have really been encouraging people to come here illegally. One Vatican watcher I'd seen this time that says that in some ways Pope Francis almost views the Trump's border wall like Pope John Paul II viewed the Iron Curtain in Europe. Of course, the big difference is the Iron Curtain was built to keep people in as opposed to Trump's wall that's actually built to try to keep people out.
But he's Reagan telling Gorbachev tear down this wall.
So he gave a speech last summer condemning Americans for racist or xenophobic attitudes, for not letting more immigrants in, which is not quite correct. We do have legal channels for 130,000 immigrants to come here each year. There are government policymakers who try to determine how many we can assimilate in a year, mm-hmm. and then at least hopefully saying that we will not be letting people come here illegally. That just encourages people to make a very dangerous journey where they're probably going to get hurt.
That's a pretty extraordinary pressure from a religious leader on a nation to essentially say you are being unchristian, and the Pope actually used that term, I think, in the middle of the presidential election when Mr. Trump was talking about this wall. He said that this was unchristian, really influencing and trying to influence immigration policy in this nation, saying that, like, putting a religious patina on the whole issue, that's a pretty extraordinary thing for him to do.
Right, and he definitely, one out of every four Americans are Catholic, so when the Pope speaks, he carries a lot of weight. And this year there was a little bit more of a divide in the Catholics. A lot of the white Irish Catholics in the Midwest did vote for Donald Trump primarily because they're sick of paying for other people's abortions under the Obamacare mandate. Though most of the Hispanic Catholics in the Southwest voted for Hillary Clinton because they thought she'd be softer on the border. And the Pope, being a Latin American, the first Latin American Pope in history, he has some sympathy for this open borders policy. I mean, it is also not to be too cynical here, but it is also true that millennial Catholics are leaving the church in droves. So, as this new Jose Gomez pointed out in his speech, he said 60% of American Catholics below 18 are Hispanic. So within a generation, this will be the Catholic Church in America. It's going to be a very Hispanic church. And so there's the Pope's talk with some measures of trying to increasingly invite more American bishops to Latin America to have like a Western Hemisphere conference as he tries to administer his U.S. congregations and Latin American congregations more or less as one unit. I was reading through his latest book, The Joy of the Gospels, recently, where he addresses immigration in there, and he actually says, he said, borders have always been a tricky concept for me. He said, I'm the head of the universal church, the mother of all. I don't like to draw lines over the globe.
Well, there are a whole lot of issues that this story touches. You certainly see, the infiltration of the Catholic Church in Latin America, just its presence there, and just how much influence it has in that part of the world, and the way that affects their approach toward immigration to the United States. But then there's also this extraordinary trend of lawlessness within the United States, and what a tremendous example this is of people who are just openly defying the laws on the books and unapologetically so. It's certainly a trend that we've seen ramping up over a period of years, but it seems like it's really reached an apex in certain ways, and this issue of immigration really seems like it's kind of the signal issue that people are using to demonstrate that lawlessness. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this trend within the United States and within the Catholic Church as well. He's writing an article on this subject that you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
God pays close attention to many anniversaries, memorials, and annual reminders. The Sabbath after Thanksgiving is one date I remember each year because it was on that date in 1994 that I attended services with the Philadelphia Church of God for the first time. That was 22 years ago. I was 22 years old at the time. So I've now spent half my life in this church, the previous years being in the Worldwide Church of God. A full human lifetime is only 7 or 8 decades. 2 decades is a pretty decent portion of a life. It's intriguing to remember back on myself as a 22-year-old and then as a 32-year-old and compare to myself today. This kind of reflection inspires overwhelming gratitude for the blessings of these past more than 2 decades. I can survey more than 21 years of being baptized, possessing and growing in the Holy Spirit, the source of spiritual understanding and power and love, over 19 years of working at headquarters in Edmond, directly contributing to God's work, nearly 18 years of marriage, building memories and absorbing all the lessons that that offers, over 16 years in the ministry, 16 years teaching at God's College, helping others' spiritual growth, over 15 years as a father, 9 years as a father of 3, working in partnership with God and with my wife at shaping these little blessings. What a marvelous education. God is very generous with opportunities to learn and to grow, developing a relationship with Him through daily prayer, continually striving to make it more spirit-minded and godlier, more vigorous, more robust, learning the skills, the workmanship of productive Bible study, coming to accept the piercing of God's spiritual sword into the joints and marrow, learning to convert words and stories and abstractions into redirected thoughts, words, and deeds, seeking biblical guidance to answer life's questions, to speak to one's own needs and the needs of the family, building relationships with other members of the body of Christ, being sharpened by the iron of Christian fellowship, learning to serve and sacrifice and love, developing a relationship with Christ's ministry, recognizing direction and seeking counsel and accepting correction. These are the courses of a character-building curriculum. These are true blessings. It is sweet and bitter and awe-inspiring to think of the faces that have come and gone over the past more than 2 decades, as well as those that have remained dedicated, immovable fixtures within the family through that time. God's supreme feat of creative accomplishment is to forge His holy, righteous character within a spirit-begotten individual, and to have witnessed more than 2 decades of that miraculous, intense process in countless hundreds, even thousands of lives, has been profoundly impressive. To have known and rubbed shoulders with many dozens illustrious heroes who have completed that course and now await their resurrection is breathtaking to contemplate. Being involved in that supreme, spiritually creative process, acquiescing to the hand of the Creator at work, is exhilarating. Looking at it with a day-to-day perspective, I can see stumbles, modest gains, needless setbacks, quiet victories, disheartening frustrations. But stepping back and looking at more than 2 decades, you can better appreciate and better recognize God's creative handiwork. Fruits appear, greater focus in work, good habits edging out bad ones, deeper love for God's law and word, sharper discernment of Satan's devices and broadcasts, keener appreciation for what is truly important in life, clearer perspective on and even gratitude for challenges and trials, genuine joy in teaching, rearing children, sharing God's truth, greater intimacy and worship. Too slowly, but bit by incremental bit, the supplanting of hypocrisy with single-mindedness, sincerity, truth. All credit goes to the husbandman. He is truly relentless in his effort to produce fruit within his children. Within the heart of every last begotten son who will yield to him, he never ceases to work away, pressing, prodding, softening, molding, toiling, hammering, healing. And because of his pity and persistence and perseverance and unending patience, over time, over decades, his efforts repay. He keeps incrementally gaining ground in his supreme feat of creative accomplishment. In the grander scheme, the last 2+ decades have witnessed an overwhelming amount of failure among the people of God. But the Father does not give up. And within his faithful remnant, the luster of God's truth and the brightness of God's presence have steadily grown. Because of the wonders of his work, they keep growing. For 2 decades, God has continually revealed more, expanded our understanding, enlarged our vision, and it's only been the beginning. God always fixes our eyes on the horizon. Where will we be in just another short decade? It promises to be brighter than any before, a world transformed. For that, I am thankful. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Cultivate the habit of being grateful for every good thing that comes to you, and to give thanks continuously. And because all things have contributed to your advancement, you should include all things in your gratitude. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.